So before I begin, he bends down. So, okay, the crowd is in a frenzy. They got stones in their hands. You know, they're testing Jesus. They can't wait to get Jesus. They can't wait to throw these stones. He bends down twice, and writes in the sand. I'm curious, before I begin, what did he write? What do you think? This is a participation part. No wrong answers. There are no wrong answers. We don't know what he wrote, so you can't be wrong. Forgive. What did he write?
Nothing. He just made himself small. Made his presence smaller.
Awesome. He didn't write anything. He just helped people slow down a little bit and made his presence smaller. What did he write? In your imagination. Sorry? I'm hungry. I like that. Somebody said something back here? What if? Beautiful. Beautiful.
He drew a circle.
So hold that thought. Hold that thought of what you think and imagine he wrote. Because now I'll tell you what he actually wrote. Just kidding. I have no idea what he wrote. This is day 10 of the crud for me. So the hands are a little shaking. So if I go over here and hold on to something, I'm actually okay. I just need something to hold on to. Let's pray. Amazing God. Create space. Help us create a space of grace within, that you might startle us today with a new word. Amen. So there was this husband and wife who, over the course of their marriage, they had very sharp exchanges over the course of their marriage. But the wife was remarkable at regarding how sharp it would happen to be. She remained calm and collected always, didn't react, never reacted. On the 20th anniversary, the husband said, "You know, I get angry a lot, and you never seem to react to my anger. You stay calm. How do you do that?" And she said, "Well, whenever I get upset, I clean the toilet." And he said, "Well, how in the world would that help you?" "I use your toothbrush." Got a funny feeling a lot of people are going to stop at Safeway on the way home today. You know, forgiveness is a lot more complex and difficult than any sermon can possibly make it out to be. We live in a culture that likes to avoid pain. We live in a culture that I think likes to deny pain. We live in a culture that likes to, anytime we're in pain, likes to numb that pain, medicate that pain, run as far away from that pain as we possibly can. We live in a culture that has this tendency to project our pain onto others. You know, and the irony is we keep hidden those very places in the darkness that need light the most. Neuroscientists have proven that psychological wounds stimulate the same place in your brain that physical wounds stimulate. You know, think about that for a second. That your brain processes emotional and physical pain the same way. But here's the thing, you know, when we're physically wounded, when we're physically wounded, it's okay to name that. It's okay to claim that. It's okay to own that. It's okay to tell others, you know, I have a broken leg. You know, it's okay to expose it to the public. It's okay to actually get help, to seek treatment. It's okay to be patient, and over time, it heals. And when we have a physical wound, there's often a scar, and that scar, actually, it's okay to show that scar to people. You know, and it leads to telling people the story that led to the scar, and we actually have a sense of pride even about how we got this scar. Emotional pain is a whole different ballgame. We're not allowed to talk about our emotional pain, our emotional wounds. We keep that buried in shame, in silence, in denial. You know, I said earlier with the kids, that the loudest voice you ever hear is your own voice. And it seems to me that we're at a loss. We're at a loss in our culture about what to do with the violence that we inflict on each other, especially men. We're at a loss to know what to do with that. You know, how do we deal with this violence that surrounds us every day? And I think we get sidetracked in arguments around that, and we don't actually get to the pain that leads to the violence. Someone beautifully wrote, violence is when grief and suffering have nowhere to go. Violence happens when there's no place to name our pain. As Richard Rohr says, pain that is not transformed is transmitted again and again and again and again. We inflict that violence on others. We inflict the violence on ourselves. We need spaces of grace where we can be weak and vulnerable before we can ever possibly be strong. You've heard me say it 1,000 times, it's our vulnerability that unites us, not our strength. But yet we present our strength to each other. Put on my favorite coat today. When I'm feeling terrible, to be totally honest with you. But that's what we do. But what we share most in common are our tears, our wounds. That's what unites us. You know, as we continue this journey where we're trying to dive deep into the heart of forgiveness, and I was reflecting this week, it seems to me that maybe the hardest person to forgive is yourself. As I said, the loudest voice you ever hear is your own voice. And so many of us, I think, carry this voice within ourselves, this voice of this inner critic, this harsh judge, this condemning voice. You know, we condemn ourselves for being human. We condemn ourselves for not being perfect. We condemn ourselves for being so weak that we feel pain, that allowing others to actually inflict pain on us, that somehow we weren't able to prevent those painful feelings. We condemn ourselves for making mistakes. We condemn ourselves for just simply not being good enough. You know, guilt is that excessive weight you carry when you do something wrong. And shame is that greater weight, that excessive pain, that inner condemnation that you didn't simply do something wrong, you are wrong. That somehow you're not worthy. You're not deserving of that love that is already there. You have to earn it somehow. You're not there yet. You're not good enough yet. Shame is that sense of just not being good enough, not being enough. And what happens is we don't often face the pain and the shame inside of ourselves, so we direct it outside of ourselves. And we find ourselves judging and condemning others because we're not looking at the way that we condemn and judge ourselves. Brené Brown, the social scientist, says, shame cannot survive empathy. Shame is healed when it can be spoken out loud. So yeah, the loudest voice you ever hear is your own voice, that inner voice of judgment, that inner voice of condemnation. But what if there's another voice? What if there's a voice of grace? What if there's a voice of wisdom? What if there's a still small voice that always is speaking to you, calling you to your belovedness, if we learn to listen? I think that's the voice in our Bible story today. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to go with me to that time when Jesus was teaching in Jerusalem. I want you to actually be standing in that circle in the crowd. And I want you to imagine this story. So here Jesus is in the temple of Jerusalem. He's teaching like all rabbis would do. He would be sitting down, actually. And it'd be a circle of people around him. And then all of a sudden there's this great interruption because the Pharisees and the scribes and the religious leaders drag this woman into the circle. And they have faces red with anger and righteous judgment. You know, and they claim that they have caught this woman in adultery. Well, in Mosaic law, according to the holiness code of Leviticus, breaking that law, adultery, speaking back to your parents, were crimes punishable by death, by stoning to death. So here these leaders think they have Jesus. They could care less about this woman. They probably could care less about what she may or may not have been involved in. They cared about Jesus. They cared about getting him, tricking him, humiliating him in public. I mean, this woman, like all women in that society, that probably wasn't the first time she was used and abused. Because women in that day had no value. Where was the man? I mean, curiously absent in the story. They didn't care about this woman. They wanted to humiliate and trick Jesus. And it was a clever trick. Because to be caught in adultery, Mosaic law says she should be executed, stoned to death. Roman law forbid Jews from performing executions. Which will it be, Jesus? Rome or Moses? I mean, they have him. They have him. I mean, the crowd is in this frenzy. Their stones gripped in their hands. They're ready to throw. The custom in this day, if you can imagine it, the woman would have been stripped to the waist, dragged into public, humiliated. The angry men would have crowded around her, shouting insults at her, spitting at her. And the crowd, their emotions would have escalated. They're ready to throw these stones. What is it, Jesus? You know the law. What will it be? He doesn't answer. He doesn't react. He doesn't escalate his own emotions. He takes a deep breath. Maybe allowing them to take a deep breath. Maybe allowing them to loosen that tightness in the chest. Loosen the grip of the stone. And he bends down. And he writes in the sand. And he slowly gets up. And he looks them each in the face. You who is without sin, be the first to throw your stone. And he bends down again and writes in the sand. And I can imagine one of the elders looks at a stone, drops it, walks away. And then a Pharisee, and another, and another, and another. And pretty soon they're all gone. Now just the two of them. And she, still lying in the dirt, she was this close to an excruciating death, barely able to breathe. And he says, is there anyone here left to condemn you? No, sir. Neither do I condemn you. Rise. Go. Sin no more. Be free. Be the person God already knows you are. I do not condemn you. I do not condemn you. I do not condemn you. Would those words be enough to free her from her shame? You know what I want to know? I want to know more than what he wrote in the sand. Do you know what I want to know? What happened to her? What happened in the days and the weeks and the months to come? Here's what I imagine. I imagine she was looking down at the sand, too ashamed to even look up. And with that very finger that he had used to write in the sand, gently, respectfully, he just lifts her chin and looks at her. And she sees someone who sees her, not for the sexual favor she may give, but for the first time for who she is, a child of God. What I like to imagine is that for the very first time, she's able to breathe. Everything is lighter. What I like to imagine is she went home, she continued to remember those words, those gentle, graceful eyes, his voice. I do not condemn you. 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 What I like to imagine is she doesn't know the day, she doesn't know the time, but all of a sudden she wakes one day and realizes that voice, those words, I do not condemn you, have become stronger than the harsh, judging critic she had always carried with her. What about the angry men? I want to know about them too. What happened to them? What I like to imagine is that the grace they encountered in that moment, that the grace that helped him to release the grip on the stone, I would love to imagine that somehow that grace also release the hate and judgment in their hearts. Because I want to believe that a new story is possible for our world. Our world that is addicted to dealing with pain by throwing stones. How about you? For you, I just invite you to imagine yourself standing before Jesus. Maybe your grip is tight on the stone you're ready to throw at someone else. Or maybe your heart feels like stone because you've been holding and hiding that pain and shame for so long. And I just want you to imagine your heart breaking open and those words falling in and finding a place to rest deep within, whispering to you again and again and again, I do not condemn you. I do not condemn you. And tell you before you know it, it's your own voice saying those words. That's what I'd like to imagine. We continue to worship God as the offering is received.